Today, things have gotten even more interesting. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Friday afternoon, and Tarek Brooker's with me. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. Here by popular demand, apparently.
People love it. They really do. Congratulations on the last show. A lot of very positive comments and one of the most successful of the week. And I thought we should talk again because there's so much going on.
Well, there is, you know, from the tensions between Russia and Ukraine to, you know, all the volatility going on in the market with everything bouncing up and down on Jerome Powell's comments and what has been said and what hasn't been said. It's certainly an interesting world out there this week.
Yeah, and I've been fascinated by what the markets are doing because, of course, if you look at the US markets, pretty much every day this week, they try to put on a surge through the earlier part of the day, but they sort of ran out of smoke and they all drop away towards the close. Interestingly, the Australian market at the moment is up. It'd be interesting to see whether it stays up or whether it also runs down again to the close. It really is, the volatility, of course, is much higher. The volatility index is up. But it really does, I think, highlight just the degree of uncertainty that there is around the place, to say nothing, of course, of the geopolitical uncertainty and even the more general political uncertainty as well. So wherever you look, you know, wobbles everywhere. I think the markets are beginning to understand that maybe, just maybe, the Fed is going to be serious about tightening the screws, but they haven't done it yet. And I would remind everybody, the Fed is still doing more quantitative easing, even as we speak.
Indeed, the balance sheet is still expanding. It's, you know, they're still doing their thing every week in, week out. And, you know, we still have near zero interest rates. And I think that's something that's important to really keep in mind about this current, you know, market issues, because all this is happening because the Fed's thinking about cutting rates. They haven't done it yet. They're talking about it. But all of this, you know, you've got a bear market in the KOSPI. You've got a bear market in China's CSI 300. You know, all this is happening with a backdrop of they haven't even done anything yet. And I've got a chart that I'll show you later in the show that shows that in terms of overall financial conditions, they're only tightened by a very, very, very small amount. And it's just fascinating that this threat that the so-called, you know, to invoke the meme that the money printer might stop going brr, all of a sudden, you know, things start to look vulnerable.
Well, they talk about the Fed put, right? And, you know, has the Fed put started to lose its force? And I guess the same is also true in Australia, right? Because here, with the inflation much higher than expected this last week, and now the talk about interest rates. Once again, of course, though, even here in Australia, the RBA is still quantitatively easing. It's still printing, buying more bonds and basically, you know, printing more stuff. So, yeah, there's a lot of words. And as I sometimes say, words and figures differ, right? So basically, they can say whatever they like, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to do anything different or have done anything different. And yet the markets are getting twitchier and twitchier. And, you know, as I read some of the commentary, it does seem to me that more and more of the market participants are now beginning to understand that maybe this time they're serious.
I think that in this instance it comes down to politics. Under you know, if there wasn't this pressure on Joe Biden and on other political leaders as a result of this, frankly, you know, extremely high inflation, you know, relative to recent decades, I don't think that we would be seeing the Fed being as hawkish as they are. You know, hawkishness from, you know, with on orders from the political leadership is now the order of the day, at least in at least in the US. You know, here in Australia, I think it could be quite a different matter considering, you know, well, how everything interacts in terms of home prices and everything like that. And, you know, while Joe Biden might want Jerome Powell to be hawkish, I'm pretty sure Scott Morrison doesn't want Philip Lowe to go down that particular road, particularly before the next federal election.
No, well, I have the view that, you know, it's going to be May probably now, which means that it's unlikely that the RBA will want to be seen to be doing anything until after the election, you know, come hell or high water, which is interesting because, as you say, the political has really contaminated the economic and the strategic in terms of independence of the Reserve Bank and the independence of the Fed. No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one because it cuts both ways. Because on one hand, you've got here in Australia where, frankly, in terms of, you know, monetary policy settings based on employment, based on growth, based on all these different things, rates should be higher. You know, it's you know, fairly simple slam dunk sort of thing. But by the same token, if you look at the US, obviously the political side of things is pushing monetary policy in a completely different direction. So there, it's really forcing the Fed to start to consider to do their actual job rather than support the market, which is what they've done over the last 2 years.
Well, I'd argue they've been supporting the market since 2008, actually. You know, we've had a decade plus of central banks just keeping all the balls in the air and just throwing a bit more liquidity on the barbie when it looks as though it could be going up.
Well, the thing is, when you actually drill down into things like, say, business finance, into business investment, these types of things that actually show you what's going on within the core of the economy, you look at Europe, you look at the US, and they're not strong numbers. They haven't been strong numbers since the GFC. And it just illustrates how vulnerable the economy is now to issues within financial markets. You know, in 2000, you know, you had the big dot-com blow up, you had all those issues, you had, yes, that did hit, you know, the economy to a degree, but then we went on and we had another, you know, what was it, seven years of growth, you know, into the financial crisis. So, but this time we're much, much more vulnerable to what occurs within financial markets because, one, they're a lot more expensive, and two, we're relying a lot, well, not when I say we, I mean as a society and particularly central bankers, relying on the wealth effect to drive economic activity because, simply put, demographics peaked quite a while ago in the West, and now we're relying on all these other strategies to try and paper over those particular cracks before the next demographic wave can, you know, sort of come to the rescue a little bit. But ironically, here in Australia and elsewhere in the Western world, we've completely blunted the positive impact of that demographic wave by indebting the larger generation of that is, you know, Gen Y with all this debt in order to basically just afford to have a home. So, you know, we've really shot ourselves in the foot in that respect.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? Because actually higher debt drains activity and funds from the economy as people service those debts. And as interest rates go up, that effect is going to be magnified tremendously. I made another point too also, Tarek. You know the CPI number was much higher, about 3.5%, right? Interestingly, of course, there the non-discretionary number was a lot higher than the discretion. In other words, people who have to spend on stuff are having to spend more. But if you actually look carefully at the way the CPI is calculated, it is understating housing costs dramatically. You know, in fact, they said in Sydney and Melbourne, the ABS said rents went down the last quarter, contrary to the CoreLogic data. But the fact of the matter is that if, in fact, the real inflation numbers are actually a lot higher than the official numbers, it means that the central banks around the world have taken interest rates too low. And despite that, we still don't have a huge amount of economic outcomes. So you can start to think that, well, maybe if inflationary forces are a lot stronger, and particularly in some household groups that perhaps are less affluent, the brakes on the economy, if they start putting interest rates up, will be magnified.
That's entirely possible. And just on, you know, you mentioning the point of housing costs within the CPI, if you look at the CoreLogic numbers, they are about 16 times higher than the ABS's. SQM's numbers are 27 times higher than the APS's, which is just, you know, it blows your mind, you know. I mean, okay, I realize that they're measuring slightly, you know, they're measuring different things. You know, the ABS is measuring the total of all rentals, while CoreLogic and SQM are measuring, you know, what is currently being advertised. But considering the number of household formations, the idea that it should be off by 16 times is just, well, you know, it's a bit ridiculous, shall we say. And it's really something.
You've got no basis on which to ground any fact, right? Because, yeah, I mean, whilst they are slightly comparing different things, the fact is that the rental proxy is the only cost element that is actually flowing into the CPI other than building and construction costs, which, of course, were also very strong. We don't have a good handle on the impact on household budgets of the higher costs of housing.
No, I agree. And this is part of what could potentially feed into wages growth and wages growth, well, more aptly, wages growth pressures, because that's what we've seen in the US. Because, they're saying that rental inflation is around about 4%, when in actual fact it's somewhere between 12 and 17, depending on who you ask. And the thing that I find fascinating about that is because the cost of living has risen so much, people are demanding more money. Because they need it, the money to keep up with, to be able to pay their bills, to be able to put food on the table. And that's one of the things that there could be an issue here in Australia, because we've seen the cost of living skyrocket. We've seen, they're talking about food prices being up nearly 7% in 2022. We've seen the cost of rents rise by very nearly double digits once you factor in the regional centres. And it's just it's crazy. We are talking about getting, 2% pay rises, 2.5% at most, at a time when the cost of living and the cost of housing is going through the roof. So, that is the real threat here, that we could continue to see wage growth pressures even if the economy rolls over. And that in particular is an issue that I see could come to fruition in the US.
Well, I agree. And there's another factor which I've noticed. I was doing my shopping today and picked up my favourite packet of biscuits, right? I thought, oh, that feels a bit light. I noticed that the packet had shrunk. So, in fact, the weight of volume that you're getting has gone down, but the price has gone up. So.
Yeah, exactly. And as a, I mean, to invoke my own story from the supermarket from yesterday, as a peasant member of Gen Y who is scrimping and saving every cent I can, I keep a very close eye on the specials at the supermarket. And the thing is that these days, when something goes on special, the special isn't nearly as special as it used to be. It's even like say for example, like real peasant stuff, which I'm quite fond of. As a peasant, you're talking about like sometimes you're talking about 20, 30% costs in the in the in it rises in the cost of things like 2-minute noodles, like specific brands, admittedly, but still, I mean, it just goes to show that those price pressures are there.
Well, and in my segmented analysis of CPI, I sort of run a back of an envelope calculation as to what the CPI is really right. Now, partly it's using the old basis rather than the new basis, but I also run it by individual household group, right? And if the 3.5% is, the baseline from the ABS, right? My number came out at about 6.8%. But for particular segments, particularly those who are less affluent and a lot of those who are in a rental situation, the average CPI over the last year was closer to 16%, right? So, 2 points. One is the average doesn't tell you anything, right? And you've got to look at it at a much more granular level, and it's understated. Secondly, in the UK, the statistics guys over there have now said they're going to actually change the way that they do their CPI calculation and do it down at a segmented level. Why? Because they said that the average number that they're producing is meaningless.
Well, exactly. I mean, like you were saying about the difference between the discretionary and the non-discretionary numbers, even from the ABS's own data. I mean, if you're a household that doesn't do much discretionary spending, say you're on a pension, say you're a retiree, or you're unemployed, or in any number of different situations, but your focus is on, food, fuel, housing, the real basics. The inflation you're experiencing is 4.5%. If that's not reason for the RBA to start raising interest rates, I don't know what is. I mean, this is hitting the people on the bottom on the bottom rungs of society the hardest. Yet, I guarantee you they're not going to turn around and give them 4.5% increases in their Centrelink payments. I'll say that much.
Well, of course, and the discretionary spend is up by 1.9%, right? But the question is, how many more flat television screens can you buy? Because they're actually gone down in price. But that doesn't help those who are trying to just manage on day-to-day budgets and just trying to decide whether they actually eat tonight or whether they clothe their kids.
Exactly. And I just on the topic of the discretionary side of things, I'd like to just provide a little bit of extra commentary on that, in that here in Australia, importers and retailers, you know, the large retailers who do their own sourcing, they are quite used to fairly significant fluctuations in prices, largely due to the effects of the fluctuations in the Australian dollar. So they are quite accustomed to absorbing costs, rising costs for a time. And I think that that might be a factor in, excuse me, that might be a factor in keeping Australia's inflation lower than it perhaps would have been if we were somewhere else in the world where, you know, where basically those costs get passed on more rapidly.
Well, that's interesting. I also have a theory that in some of those discretionary areas, in fact, the profit margins in Australia have been and continue to be quite a lot higher than in other areas around the world. So they actually have more latitude to swallow some of the costs in the short term as well. If you look at the margins in, for example, the US or in the UK, in some discretionary categories, they are a whole lot lower.
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Australia is a little bit legendary for our margins, you know, whether it's retail margins or, well, the real big one is bank margins, you know.
Oh yes. Exactly. No, somehow the banks managed to still turn out remarkably strong profits and big fees and everything else. And of course those credit card rates haven't dropped at all. But don't get me started on the banks, or we won't ever get to your slides, Tarek, which we should probably do before we run out of
Yeah, okay. No, sounds good, mate. Fire it up.
Go on then. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, you know, it's a, well, like I said before, it's all happening and we'll kick off. Now, one of the big things happening at the moment is the issues with Russia and Ukraine, which are arguably putting a fairly solid floor under oil prices, at least at the time of the recording of this show. Despite the fact that we've seen a fairly significant downturn in US stocks and stocks around the world, oil prices have remained near multi-year highs. And this is part of why. As you can see from this nice little map from the Institute for the Study of War, it basically shows that Russia is quite well placed to make a fairly solid push on a large proportion of Ukraine. And that is something that is continues, you know, there continues to be tensions on that today. And really, it's a really tough one to know which way it's going to go.
Now that is very interesting, Tarek. And of course, the point there is that Ukraine is caught in the middle, right? Because they want to be independent and they want to actually run their own destiny, but they've basically got the West reaching out and saying, "Well, come our way," right? And they're one of six special relationship countries that are edging closer to NATO and Europe. Whereas Russia is saying, no, hang on a moment, this is part of the border area. We don't want you coming any closer. So they really are caught in the middle. And it's interesting if you go back in history that last time Ukraine was part of the USSR, and when it happened in the 30s, millions of people died as a result of that. So it's not like they've got a huge alignment to Russia either. So, it is a really interesting and very precarious situation. But when you look, see the map there, you can see just how much people are, built around the edge, right?
That they are, and I think that the thing is in 2014, when when Russia's man was removed from power, you know, I think that really sort of set the tone for where we are today, because you know the Russians see Ukraine as basically their backyard. You know, their fleet has been based in Crimea for a for a long, long time, and that's part of why the Russians annexed Crimea. But it's also the fact that a lot, basically under Khrushchev, who had a great affinity for Ukraine, a lot of Soviet industry was relocated to Ukraine during the Cold War. And basically, a fairly sizable portion of Russia's military hardware, the componentry for it, came from Ukraine prior to 2014. So I'll give you an example. So, for example, Russian helicopters, the larger attack helicopters, transport helicopters, up until relatively recently, 80% of the engines came from Ukraine. Or, for example, the Russian small frigates, which they're building in relatively large numbers. Some of those had their engines made by by shipbuilders in the Ukraine. And once the Russian contracts disappeared, those shipbuilders needed to find something else to do. And now some of them did make tin cans for a living. So it just goes to show how interconnected the Russian and Ukrainian economies really are.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's why it's such a complex situation. Then, of course, the West and the US have a particular view of the future, and Russia has another view of the future. I remember I spent a long time in Poland, and what I hadn't realized until I actually worked there was just how those countries in the middle of Europe, you know, get overrun from one way or the other way and the other way and the other way. I mean, it's been in like that for years and years and years and decades and decades. It is a very, very vulnerable set of structures, and it's no wonder that individual countries get quite twitchy quite quick.
No, indeed. This is one of the key factors as well in the Ukraine situation, because Europe's gas storage levels are so low, well below even the one standard deviation behind the current 5-year average. It just goes to show just how vulnerable Europe is to Russia choosing to strike within the next few months. Because if they do, the Europeans are stuck over a barrel. Do they respond and risk Russia cutting off the gas, or what exactly do they do? And if they do decide, if some of them do decide to cut Russia off or to side with the US in terms of imposing sanctions, there could be quite a schism in Europe between the different nations over what the right response is. Because obviously, you know, depending on who does what, you could see one country who wants Russian gas to keep flowing potentially cut off from Russian gas because of the transit through countries who do oppose Russia. So it's a really, really complex situation if things really do kick off.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Normandy group, of course, is saying one thing. France is very vociferous in one direction, Germany less so. The other point was interesting that ScoMo is offering to send liquid gas, and Biden has also said, well, we'll provide some gas to Europe if necessary, right? I mean, you know, you can't make this stuff up, can you?
No, and the thing is that they can promise to send all the gas they want. It's not going to be enough. You know, Europe gets too much of its gas from Russia. And frankly, even if they were going to do it, they would have had to do it a lot earlier. I mean, perhaps in the past, you know, if they had decided to do this 2 or 3 months ago, if they decided to send convoys of ships carrying LNG to Europe, then yeah, sure, they probably could have provided them with more than enough. But with the way things are now heading into the middle of the European winter, it's too late.
Too little, too late.
Yeah. Okay, now this is an interesting one. Earlier today, it was claimed by a senior Ukrainian official who spoke with CNN that a Russian invasion was virtually a certainty. Now, since then, both the White House and the office of the Ukrainian president have walked back these claims, saying that it was basically that it wasn't said in such serious and certain terms. But the question is that actually what transpired or not? Or is it just the fact that Biden, you know, said the quiet part out loud again, and they're trying to cover for him? And the truth is, he's made some fairly major gaffes regarding the Ukraine recently, so perhaps he was just speaking the truth again. I mean, we don't know.
Well, it's a little invasion, isn't it?
No. what's it just a few border regions between friends?
Exactly.
But on the right there, we've got there basically the absurd balance of forces between Russia and Ukraine. Obviously, Russia on paper just absolutely crushes Ukraine and crushes them quite badly. But the thing that's interesting is that the Russians have about 100,000 troops on around the borders on their own border with Ukraine and on the Belarusian border with the Ukraine, currently engaged in military exercises, or so they say. But the thing is that obviously the Ukrainians are going to throw the kitchen sink at defending their country if it does come to blows. So while the Russians have committed a sizable proportion of their active military to the region and to a potential attack if it does end up occurring, they are going to potentially be outnumbered at a local level by the Ukrainians. So they are going to be relying fairly heavily on their firepower advantage. So it could, you know, it could get quite messy and quite challenging if, especially if the Ukrainians, you know, decide to basically just let the Russians have, you know, a little bit of territory and then force the Russians to fight in an urban area.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, Tarek, about that is that if you are defending your own country, you're going to throw everything at it, aren't you? Whereas perhaps if you're coming in from outside and thinking about grabbing some territory, you may have a different set of priorities, but also perhaps the quantum of risk that you can take and the debt that you can put up with will be different. So it'll be interesting to see what that means in terms of the power play between the two parties there.
Exactly. I think you're spot on that morale and, you know, the will to fight are going to be absolutely key on both sides should it descend into open warfare. Because, I mean, obviously, like you say, you've got the one side of things where you're defending your country, you're defending your home, your family, etc. But then by the same token, you've got the absolutely terrifying firepower of, you know, a large proportion of Russia's armed forces raining down on you. And you don't have you you're not you don't even have the terrain on your side to help defend to help defend yourself. So, you know, it's if it does descend into, you know, into mortal blows, it's going to be messy.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I was reading something the other day, so people suggesting, well, of course, whatever happens, it'll be done over quick. History of invasions, in areas of Europe or indeed the Middle East suggests that things don't necessarily go over quick.
Well, Hitler and Napoleon, I would have probably have a little bit to say about that.
Exactly.
No, I think, you know, to talk about, you know, just for, like you said, about these things not being over with quickly and things getting messy. You know, I mean, say for example, when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, it was, you know, obviously at first they steamrolled the Russians. They took hundreds of thousands of prisoners within the opening weeks, and they basically completely destroyed large parts of the Soviet Air Force and their tank corps. But by the same token, the Germans paid an extremely high price for that in casualties, and that is something that the Russians would potentially face if they do decide to get involved in a protracted war in the Ukraine. Because even if they do keep casualties relatively low, perhaps in the, you know, the sort of tens of thousands in a protracted war, you're talking about the crack units of the Russian military. You're not talking about, you know, just losing a broader cross-section of the Russian military. You're talking about the ones who've been trained for combat, the ones who you're going to need if there's a, if another greater war breaks out, which is something that obviously, you know, Russia is concerned about.
Absolutely. And as with all of these things, you take one step, but you're never quite sure what the next step's going to be. And I suppose, the bottom line for me is to what extent is Putin doing this because he can versus, what Ukraine is trying to achieve in its own right, and then what the West is trying to achieve, and particularly, I guess, the Euro zone. But as I said earlier on, even in the Eurozone, there is not a single position on this. There is quite a lot of divergence, and I think that in itself is quite interesting too.
Indeed, I mean, I think the comments of the now former German naval chief were really quite illuminating on the issue, because he basically said that we need to respect Russia, we need to stay out of Russia. Basically, to sum up and to paraphrase, we need to stay out of Russia's face and sphere of influence, because we need them to be on our own side if we basically get into a more, you know, a cold war or potentially, you know, a hot war with China. And I mean, it's a hard, I mean, looking at things from a European perspective, it's a hard assertion to disagree with, because he's like, well, we should just let the Ukraine be the Ukraine, let them do their own thing, and basically we should worry about the Chinese because they're a much greater existential threat. And I mean, let's be honest, you know, if Russia gets into a war with Europe and the US, it's going to be horrible. You know, it's potentially going to turn into an absolute horrific event, you know, like that we haven't seen the like since World War II, and eventually they're going to lose. So the thing is, you know, it's not something that you want to get bogged down in, but really they're not an existential threat to the primacy of the West in the same way that China is.
No, that's right. I mean, I think it's a bit of chalk and cheese, but I'll also make the point that sometimes a war can be a bit convenient when things at home aren't going too well?
Well, ironically, you know, a limited war that causes a bit of trouble might actually be beneficial for both sides to some degree. But I mean, politically, you know, politically, I should clarify, but, you know, it could be quite damaging economically. And that's another angle in all of this as well, because if Putin does choose to strike in the next few months, while Europe is vulnerable because of the gas situation, but also because the markets are vulnerable. You know, if you're talking about, you know, potential, say hypothetically, you know, the Fed continues to be hawkish, you see US stocks enter a bear market, are they really going to be willing to cut Russia out of the global financial system with that backdrop, with the potential that the Russians are going to cut off oil and gas exports to the world, you know, or even just cut them off to some degree, to the point that they can just make everyone's life a misery through high energy prices? Are they going to be willing to do that under those circumstances?
Or could it be that, you know, if there's a bit of war over there, well, we'll have to go print a bit more money, right? We'll have to keep the markets up. So maybe it's another a reason for the Fed to continue its quantitative easing programs.
I don't know. I mean, it's possible. I mean, I'd be looking at the other side of that, because, I mean, if inflation keeps going up and up and up, it, you know, as a result of higher energy prices, it's going to, you know, then you're going to really start to see the issues of a wage growth feedback loop starting to be, you know, present in the US, and that would really start to entrench inflation in a way that I don't think Fed could accept.
No, and that's exactly interesting, because in some other conflicts, in fact, inflation moved up smartly and faster because, of course, energy was, you know, in short supply and all those things. Yeah, so it just shows you how multifaceted this whole thing is. And I have to say, in the mainstream, a lot of the conversations seem to me to be very myopic and one side or the other side. You know, this is a much more complicated jigsaw puzzle. And I think it's good that we've been able to explore it a little bit.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I hope it's proved valuable for the viewers. Okay, now, I remember in the first time we first chatted, and I did one of these slideshows with all the charts, we talked about inventory builds back in the middle of, I think it was about May last year. We talked about how basically that eventually you would see excess inventory and inventory starting to build in a big, big way, and that would eventually put downward pressure on prices in the long term. And hey presto, the inventory build has started in a big, 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 big way.
Now, this is US, right?
This is US, yes. Yeah. They have seen the largest ever US retail inventory build in the history of statistics on a month-on-month basis. And we've had, and not only that, but the month before that was also a near record month as well. Now, in terms of inflation adjusted inventories, because naturally with inflation rocketing, you can't just look at the dollar value of things. Retail inventories are sitting about 3% above where they were prior to the pandemic. So when you factor in demand, they're actually, you know, sort of fairly significantly below where they probably should be. But it just goes to show, if these inventory builds continue at anywhere near this sort of rapid pace, it's not going to take long for these inventory builds to become a drag on corporate profitability. And obviously, you're going to potentially then see the issue of having to cut prices, because the most recent US retail sales data showed retail sales falling by more than 2% when the expectation was for them to be flat. So if you put those two factors together, and if those two factors remain an issue, things could get quite interesting in terms of the goods inflation figures in the US towards the middle and the latter end of the year.
Yeah, it's interesting, because the latest IMF figures in terms of forward expectations of growth were actually ratcheted back this week. And one of the things that they mentioned was the slowdown in retail in the US. And of course, the retail is such a huge part of the US. And I guess there's a couple of things there. One is, to what extent is it you can't get what you want to buy when you want to buy it, which was what was going on earlier on. But if, in fact, the inventory has gone up, there's something else here, and that is maybe people can't afford now. You know, they've spent their government checks, and suddenly the financial pressures are beginning to build, and so they're actually ratcheting back their spending. If that's the case, this is a very significant move.
Indeed, and I think it's a multifaceted issue, because on one hand, people aren't spending because of inflation. You know, they're tightening their belts. You know, they're spending less. and they're less confident about the future. You know, I mean, even there was a study recently that basically showed that around 80% of Americans believe that they would either be the worse off or the same over 2022, despite the fact that apparently the US economy has experienced its best year ever. And, you know, all these economists are toasting themselves.
And the bankers are.
Well, yeah, and you know, a few of the partisan cheerleaders are all going, are all very, very happy. But I think that just speaks to the broader issue within the economy. Because on one hand, like as I said, you've got the fall in confidence, but then on the other side of things, you've also got basically the mean reversion in retail sales back towards their pre-pandemic trend. You know, they weren't going to stay elevated forever. You know, all this is built on displaced services spending and stimulus. And once you take away both those things, particularly as we do see a normalization of the US economy and money starts flowing back into services, you know, well, to be completely frank, of course it was going to happen eventually. And ironically, that's exactly what we talked about last May.
I know. Well, we're ahead of the curve, I'm afraid. We can't help it. We just are. And the other point, of course, is that the Build Back Better program, you know, what Biden's big spend, is still stuck, right? And that's the other thing that the IMF took out of their latest numbers, because they're now not sure that it will actually ever happen.
No, and more U.S. fiscal stimulus is looking increasingly doubtful. I mean, there was actually a bill proposed in U.S. Congress, which it won't pass, but it was proposed that they basically disallow further stimulus measures if U.S. inflation is above 4.5%. So it just really goes to show how it's turned into this political hand grenade that's really starting to blow up in Biden's face.
Absolutely. Politics is everywhere, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, this is just like as what we're talking about with inventories previously, but in the US Q4 GDP data that came out overnight, it showed that of the total, 71% of the growth in Q4 was inventories and nothing more than inventory building. And inventory building obviously isn't something that's going to be of long-term benefit. You can't build inventory every quarter. So that's eventually going to basically disappear, or in some cases even reverse, as it has many times on a much smaller scale since forever, because, you know, that's as you can see from the chart. So while everyone's crowing about the US economy growing in the sixes, and obviously that's on an annualized basis, in reality it's much more likely, once you take away the inventory build, that it's more growing at a sort of in the mid to high ones. So in year-on-year terms, you're talking about spending trillions and trillions of dollars and achieving, you know, 0.4, 0.5% quarter-on-quarter GDP growth, which is frankly garbage.
Well, it's interesting that Powell, in his remarks after the announcement on Wednesday, was very keen to be upbeat with regard to the performance of the economy, right? And I was thinking, yeah, but hang on, the data isn't in line with what you're saying is going on. You know, you're saying it's all wonderful, but there are so many indicators wherever you look: confidence, spend, now the GDP number. You know, this is a shaky situation, and this is with all of that stimulus still in place.
Yeah, exactly, and that's exactly what we talked about last May: relative stagflation, and that's exactly what we have. If you're throwing trillions and trillions of dollars of stimulus at the economy, if you're throwing the greatest wealth effect in the history of the world at the economy, 0.5% GDP growth is absolutely pathetic. It's stagflationary. And to be completely frank, if you look at the US wage growth, that's deeply negative. US real wage growth is deeply negative.
Yeah, that's right, because the inflation is running a lot faster than wages growth. And interestingly, of course, wages growth is not uniformly spread across the economy. There are a few sectors where it's quite strong, but there are lots where there's almost no sign of growth. And that's, of course, where all this pressure comes back to hit businesses and households.
Well, exactly right. I mean, if you're part of, say, for example, you're not in a terribly in demand job. You know, you work in a private sector job, and you know you're not a trucker. You don't work in a warehouse. You're not in one of these jobs that is in really high demand. you know, it's entirely possible that you're seeing 2.5% wage growth, all at a time when other professions are seeing rocketing wage growth, and you've seen your rent rise by more than 10%. You've seen your grocery bill rise by more than 7%, and not only that, but now you're getting a bit annoyed. You're gonna want a wage rise. You're gonna want something to help keep up with the cost of living, and that really potentially leads into the nightmare scenario for the Fed, which is that 1970s style feedback loop in wages and inflation.
Yeah, and if you go back to that era, right, at the start of that, they said inflation was transitory. That was their first reaction, right? The second step they took was they actually redefined how they measured inflation, right? They took some stuff out and changed it. And then third, they still denied that there was embedded inflation, even though, you know, wages demands started to rise because all the cost of living started to rise. And they were basically 3 or 4 years behind the curve, right? And I was reading something earlier in the week, and they said, look, you've got to understand, monetary policy is like an oil tanker, right? You know, you pull the lever and nothing happens for 6 to 12 months, and then slowly it sort of turns one way or the other, right? But by then, things have moved on again, right? The whole set of levers that they've got don't work very fast and effectively. And secondly, if your main lever is the interest rate lever and that's all you're pulling, which is what the Fed seems to be frankly wanting to do, that's even more likely to take a more extended duration before it really hits anything. So in a way, you know, you sort of think they're pulling the levers and it's not connected to anything real.
No, exactly. And I think that, to be completely honest, I think it's going to hit the market long before it hits the economy, to be completely honest with you. You know, like, you look at things and you know, that they say that the lag between the impact on the economy of rate hikes or rate cuts is about a year to 18 months, depending on who you ask. And a year from now, can you imagine a year of half a dozen rate hikes from the Fed or more, of what that would do to the market? That's going to tame inflation long, long before rate hikes start to really bite on consumers, particularly in the US, where 90% of people have fixed mortgages. You know, it's going to break markets long before that happens, I think. And that I think is probably the more immediate threat in terms of rate hikes. I mean, obviously, say here in Australia, it would drag on households, in some particular households, fairly significantly. But I think that things are going to start to go wrong in markets before that. And that could render all this a completely moot point, because that could completely kill inflation in its tracks. And you could start to see that those deflationary factors start to take over.
Well, as you know, I still have this sense that deflation is still there over the horizon. We haven't quite got there yet. But once you start lifting rates and once lending starts to ease back and, you know, all the credit growth stops, at that point, the deflationary forces really do start to build. And if you go back over history, those deflationary cycles are incredibly hard to stop once they actually gain momentum. And we don't have enough armory in the locker at the moment, sort of in terms of monetary policies, to be able to turn it around. So my theory is we're going to see interest rates go up a little, but then they're going to have to be cut again. And I still think there is a reasonable chance that negative interest rates, real interest rates, are going to be part of the game over the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, you know, it once again goes back to our first chat with the charts. It's just, inflation, deflation, why not both? You know, inflation, then deflation or disinflation, you know, depending on what they end up doing with the fiscal side.
Absolutely. Well, that's, of course, the other question. You know, will they go on just throwing more money at it and, you know, hand more handouts? But that's got to be paid for ultimately.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, but inflation needs to get low enough to be able to them to justify it politically.
Exactly.
Okay, now this is yet another part of the puzzle in terms of the weaker economic data that's been emerging. The US services PMI has surprised to the downside in a big, big way. They thought that it was going to come in around about 55, which was, you know, a fairly serious strong expansion, and it came in at only 50.9, which is basically nearing relative stagnation. Now, there's been quite a few people who've come out and they've said, oh, it's because of Omicron, blah, 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 blah. But the question is then, is why was it still very, very strong during Delta when things were much, much worse? when people were taking COVID much, much more seriously and were much, much more concerned about it. So this is yet another part of the puzzle that shows that between you've got, on one hand, you've got reversing retail sales, and now you've got a weakening services sector. So this is the real issue for the Fed, because this is arguably stemming from inflation hitting consumer confidence and hitting consumer spending. Because it used to be that, oh, you know, a PMI surprise to the downside. Whoa, that means we're going to be able to cut monetary policy more, or we're going to be able to do more QE, or just keep the ridiculous settings where they are. But now when this happens, it's, oh, crap. We really need to do something about this before inflation starts to kill the economy, which only increases the impetus on the Fed to act to raise rates. I mean, a March rate hike even 4 or 5 months ago was considered insane.
Well, that's right. And, you know, now the market is saying 3 to 4. Some people, Jamie Dimon including, is saying a lot more than that, you know, so we'll see. The other point, though, I was reading about a month ago, somebody saying, well, you know, we've got goods inflation at the moment, but don't worry, because the services sector will come back in and that will actually ease some of the pressure prices in the goods sector. In other words, they were banking on the services sector being effectively the get out of jail card, and if that data is anything like right, that ain't working.
No, and the thing is, services inflation is already accounting for 2.2% of the US inflation rate. So, and that's obviously of the 2.2% of the 7, not of the total. As in 100%, but it just goes to show that if and services inflation is roughly where it's been pretty much this in the, you know, pre-pandemic, so it hasn't really taken off yet. But as these businesses finally start to, you know, reopen their doors, and or as you know, as they start to reprice things, particularly because their costs have risen, their you know, the inputs into their businesses have risen, and they need to pass them on to maintain their profitability or even just maintain their business's viability. It's gonna feed into higher inflation again. So, you know, it's kind of ridiculous to think that services inflation is going to be able to be easily tamed. I mean, don't get me wrong, they could manage to see it get tamed, but only on the back of a falling consumer spend.
Absolutely, and remember, of course, that some service categories are actually more elastic to price rises than products, right? So you know, there is more upside potentially, but that leads to higher inflation, which goes back to our earlier point.
Yep, the potential of the wage feedback loop.
Yep.
Okay, now this one I quite like. It basically, it shows the spread between treasury yields and junk bonds. Now, this is one of the indicators that the Fed likes to watch to basically see that if things are blowing out and if they need to engage in some form of intervention. Now, so far, the spread between junk bonds and treasury yields, we're not even where we were in November. It's basically a giant nothing burger. I mean, even if they rise by another sort of 20% from here in relative terms, we're only where we were towards the end of last year. So it just goes to show that this rout in stocks hasn't spread into other parts of the market yet. Now, I'm not saying that it won't. If it keeps going, it will. But it's not throwing off these signals that could prompt the Fed to intervene. And that's, I think, a really, really key thing in all this, because the entire market has been built on the idea that if things get bad enough, the Fed will intervene. But if stocks can keep falling without having a huge blowout in bond yields and in bond spreads, then they could fall a lot further before the Fed finally steps in. And that would really screw up a lot of people's plans.
Absolutely. Well, that was interesting to see that... you know, a couple of people who claimed on the market were well said, well, you know, 60-40 split, right? 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Bonds are still, you know, they're fine at the moment and nothing is really going. And if that's true, and if this data is true, then you're right. There's more latitude to allow the stock markets to some would say, correct back to more normal levels, because some of the valuations are hugely extended at the moment. And the recent results over the last quarter, which are just coming out at the moment in the US, have not necessarily justified the valuations that we're seeing, particularly if you discount forward profits at a higher interest rate. That's a sort of a sustainable correction, as it were, right? And if that's true, then the Fed will be relatively relaxed about it. So, yeah, the cavalry may not be coming over the hill anytime soon.
No, and I mean, ironically, back in early January of 2020, before things really started to kick off in terms of the pandemic, Jerome Powell came out and said about, when asked about the stock, high stock prices, which had then had a S&P 500 at about 3,200, he said that he was concerned that they were somewhat elevated. We're at 4,400, you know, 4,400 today.
Yes.
After a global pandemic, relying on monetary and fiscal stimulus, and displaced services spending. And it's just, it's really something.
Well, I mean, it shows you that all of that excess liquidity that's been created is sloshing around looking for a home, right? And the obvious homes as well, real estate, I suppose, or bonds, but stocks. And that's where a lot of it's gone. And some have gone into crypto, although a recent crypto story, a different story in terms of growth recently. But the interesting question is, what happens if that liquidity just starts to get drained? You know, where does it all go then? And does that reduce the demand? And if it reduces the demand, that's another reason why stocks could fall further.
Indeed. And it's also the eventually retail is going to sell if this continues. You know, like there was an institutional piece that that someone shared on Twitter that basically said that retail is still buying the dip. They're still buying every dip, especially the big ones. And that's part of why we keep seeing these big rebounds, because of these large inflows into either single stocks or in a lot of cases, ETFs. So eventually, we haven't had a capitulation moment yet. You know, I mean, the Russell 2000 is down, well, was down almost 20%. And we haven't had a capitulation event yet. We haven't had that big sell-off, that big disorderly blow-up that's defined things in the last couple of years, you know, even in, you know, 2018, 2019. So, you know, there is that potential latitude for things to get quite a bit more messy.
Well, the institutional investors, a lot of them are still on the sidelines, so they've not come in the last few days, right? So they've tended to sit on the sidelines and say, we think there's more downside, so we're not going to buy the dip currently, we're just going to sort of sit there and let it happen, right? And as you say, retail investors, particularly some newbies, have piled back in and, you know, tried to make it a little bit. But I will make the point that there are a lot more traders, in other words, people coming in, coming out, rather than people who are trying to invest for long-term value at the moment. And the other thing to bear in mind is you've got all the algos working as well, right? So there's this huge machine trading thing going on. And some of the reasons why we're getting the daily moves that we're getting is the machines just doing what they're doing, right? So in a way, they're exacerbating some of the liquidity moves and the volatility moves. The sensible money from some of those more strategic investors are still sitting on the sidelines. And a few of them I've been reading said, well, we're going to sit on the sidelines until things have come a lot lower than where they are at the moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all really up to the Fed, and it's also just up to the market, because the thing is, we have seen the sort of procedural way that the markets deteriorations unfold occur, except it's occurred over a lot longer period. You know, at first you saw falling EM stocks. You know, you started to see, you know, weakness in the meme stocks. You know, I mean, something like 50% of NASDAQ components, of overall NASDAQ components, not the core, but the overall, are down more than 50%. You know, so from their all-time highs, I should say. And it just goes to show that this isn't something that has just happened out of the blue, because Jerome Powell has spoken, you know, and from his stone tablet from on high. It's been happening for a long while so far. It's been happening in other parts of the market, other you know, in other places around the world. You've seen a lot of weakness in Chinese and other Asian stocks. You've seen weakness in the Nikkei, and it just goes to show that this has been unfolding for a while now because the market isn't comfortable with these levels of valuations, at least not under the current circumstances.
No, that's right. And interesting, again, I was reading this today, that someone's making a comparison of tech stocks in China and tech stocks in the US, right? And their argument was it's a timing thing because, of course, tech stocks in China have come down significantly, right? And if you do a bit of a slidey woo, right, so you basically move the China tech and the US tech back a bit, they mirror each other significantly. So basically his view is that the tech stocks are going to go a lot further down than where they currently are because they're going to follow a similar trajectory to where, what China did.
Well, that's an interesting one. I'll be curious to have a look at the chart of that.
Yep.
Okay. Now, this is a nice little proxy for basically for, you know, business activities, shipments, and, you know, the flow of goods, really, because it shows the S&P 500 charted against the total tonnage of the trucks are moving around the US. Now, despite the fact that you've seen massive demand for goods, the truck tonnage index is still well below where it was in 2019. Yet the correlation between the truck tonnage index and the S&P 500, despite them tracking each other closely for the best part of 20 years, has been completely broken. Now, some people have said that this is partially because of obviously the shift towards greater levels of emphasis on tech, on tech earnings. But I would say that the last few years have seen tech earnings, I mean, even if you look, say, between the 2016 and the 2019 period, tech earnings have performed very, very well. So I think there's really something to this chart and to just the broader idea that the economy is significantly weaker than stocks would suggest, and that the foundations underpinning earnings are weaker than they first appear.
Right, and that what that says again is that if you isolate all of the stimulus from the Fed and from, you know, fiscal, and look at the underlying dynamics on the economy, right, which is the tonnage line, it says that there's a bubble.
Yeah. And I mean not only that, but that is where things are sitting today, after the stimulus, after everything, after all this stuff's been thrown at the economy. So the question is, where is it going to sit when all of that ends, and in particular the wealth effect reverses? So, you know, it's going to be really interesting because, you know, you've still got the rich folks buying record numbers of Porsches, Rolls Royces, super yachts, you know, record private jet travel. And that's what consumer spending looks like with them splashing these billions. But what's it going to look like when it's like, oh, crap, the market's falling, you know, whenever that may be.
Yep. And just two other quick words, margin call.
Yeah.
Yep. I've seen some very interesting data on the impact of margin calls so far. And, of course, as you come below 10%, suddenly those margin calls get louder and more frequent. And people are highly leveraged, including some very affluent people are highly leveraged. So that could be another feedback loop on the negative side in terms of keeping people from spending.
Indeed. Now, this is what I was referring to about financial conditions tightening, and you know you can see that tiny little uptick just at the bottom right hand corner of the chart there. That is one of the main drivers of all of this, that little tightening in financial conditions. Now, while obviously it's also the expectation of further tightening in terms of overall financial conditions, we are still far and away from the way things were prior to the pandemic. And it just goes to show just really just how reliant the market is on just very, very loose monetary policy and the continued flow of monetary stimulus.
Yeah, so basically what you're saying is, apart from all the words, in fact, hardly anything has really tightened.
Yeah. But they haven't, have they? I mean, yeah, they're still buying billions of dollars of bonds a month. They've still got record lows, you know, 0%. Basically 0% interest rates. So yeah, exactly. The tightening hasn't really even started. I mean, at least in the US. Yeah. I mean, obviously in other countries it has. You know, the UK and New Zealand have both raised interest rates. You know, countries across Eastern Europe have. So yeah, but in the US it's a very different story.
Yeah, it's interesting. Also, some of the countries in America, you know, Central America, they've also started lifting some big moves in Chile and Mexico too. So in some pockets around the world, rates are going up quite dramatically. But you've got to say, you look at the major economy, the US economy, and it's a little one. But, you know, they're still throwing more liquidity on the fire.
Yeah, and they're not going to stop. No. But, you know, that we'll see that this tightening and everything, and then, you know, eventually, either, you know, the economy will deteriorate or something will break in the market, and then they'll be right back on again, just like it was in 2018 when they resumed QE, and just like 2019 when they resumed rate cuts.
Yeah, so absolutely.
I'd love to think that I'm wrong and that there's going to be this whole Volcker-esque change to monetary policy and they're going to start hammering inflation and taking things seriously, but yeah, somehow I doubt it.
Well, you know, do leopards change their spots? Do central banks change their strategies? No, not really. They've got a particular set of interests which is supporting their interests, as it were. And all of the words about, you know, yes, we're working for the broader economy and for, you know, ordinary people. Show me the evidence.
They will change their spots for as long as it's politically necessary for them to.
Exactly.
Okay, now I thought this was a good spot to end the slideshow for the week. It shows where the market is pricing the RBA cash rate to be over a very long period, in a year's time and 10 years' time. And, well, basically, just it doesn't look good if you've it obviously if this comes to fruition, it doesn't look good if you've bet big on low rates being part of your investment strategy.
Yeah, and there's two observations, Tarek. The first is, of course, a big spike and then coming back a bit, which is what we've both been saying, that the chances are that rates will have to come back. The interesting question is, will it drop lower than that 4 to 5 year rate that they're talking about? But, this is a very different environment from what we've currently got at the moment.
It is. It's going to be quite interesting. Personally, I don't think any of this is going to happen. Mm. I think things are going to start to break, and this is all going to look ridiculous, and everyone's going to go, you know, this is going to end up like one of those RBA wage growth charts where we think that everything's going to go uppity, uppity, up, and then all of a sudden something breaks. You know, I mean, I'd love for it to happen. I think it would be fantastic for people to actually, you know, get a return on their money, you know, rather than these paltry interest rates you collect when you make a deposit at the bank and sort of start to restore a bit of equilibrium to the housing market. I mean, can you imagine if in, what is that, 3 years' time? So start of 2025, if interest rates have gone up by, what's that, 2.5%. So you'd be looking at an RBA variable mortgage rate average of about 5.6 to 6%.
So
about 5.6. So you're basically, for a lot of households, doubling their servicing costs.
Absolutely.
Based on even on variable rates.
Yeah.
If you're someone who's bought in at a cheap fixed rate back at one, you know, the 1.7s, the 1.8s, your servicing costs in terms of interest are tripled.
Yeah, and for many people that would be above the buffer that the banks actually did their calculation on before APRA did their last expansion of the buffer.
Yeah, exactly. And to be honest, it's something will break. Yeah. Long before then. Yeah. I'd love to see it happen. It would be great. But the problem is the economy is just too addicted to low rates and to, you know, the wealth effect that comes from property.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we should just put the chart full screen again so people can look at it in all its glory, right? With a cash rate of above 2.5% in 3 years' time and in 10 years' time sitting at around 2.5% again. That would be a very, very different environment for what we've got today. And the consequences for ordinary households and businesses, the consequences for people with large mortgages, the consequences for the banks, to say nothing of the political fallout, it would be pretty amazing. Now, that's a market pricing, right? So that's basically...
That's a market. Yeah.
It's a stake in the ground as to what the markets are thinking. But if you look at the expectation on the yield curves and, you know, the bond rates, this is the sort of story that you've got. And the other thing is to say, if you did this same chart 6 months ago, right, it was much lower all the way out, right? So the trajectory is higher and moving higher, and that's something which I think may well keep a few people awake at night.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's going to be really fascinating to watch, because there hasn't been planning on any of this. And I will say one thing is that whoever wins the next election might be getting a poison chalice, because I mean, if this somehow comes true, if in 3 years, you know, from now, the RBA cash rate is 2.6%, that is going to make the next government's life an absolute misery. And it's going to make getting reelected very, very difficult.
Well, I would love to be a fly on the wall next Tuesday when the Reserve Bank meets for its first meeting after its long holiday, you know, all sitting on the beach and just forgetting everything about what's been going on. They've got some serious conversations to have and some serious decisions to take, because if in fact they're going to start to have to lift rates way sooner, and there's a political challenge there as well, there are some economic consequences just around the corner. And if that chart is in any way a forward predictor of what may happen, we're in for a very tight time.
Yeah, well, let's be honest. I mean, even two-thirds of that is going to make things very, very challenging for the economy and for the housing market. I mean, if you price in that sort of rates into the economy, and you know, not only that, but with the end of the TFF starting to feed through with all that sort of impact on bank funding costs coming through in the next few years, rates could go even higher.
Correct.
Because they've been kept artificially low by all this liquidity, and also the fact they've also been kept low by QE, by the government suppressing the short end bond rates. So if you take both of those things out of the equation, all of a sudden it gets a lot more expensive for the banks to fund mortgages, and Things could get really messy if we do see protracted inflation and those rate hikes as the market predicts.
Absolutely. Well, Tarek, it's been a very interesting ramble through your charts. Thank you very much for all the effort you put into them. And as always, I think you make some really, really important and quite disturbing points. And really enjoyed speaking with you. I'm sure we'll do it again soon, because there's so much to talk about.
Well, you know, we'll just have to see what happens with the markets. But if it's all happening, you know, and everything's crashing down around us all over again, then it might be sooner than we expect.
Yeah, okay. We'll catch you soon anyway. Thanks.
No worries, mate. Catch you later.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.